Hello and welcome to Fireside with the VC. My name is Andrew Romans, and I'm very excited to have Rob Siegel on the pod. Rob, I've known for quite a few years. I think we both maybe started officially investing as VCs around the same time, but we met at a party in Silicon Valley. He is a lecturer at Stanford Graduate School of Business, you know, which some people think of as the number one MBA program in the world. Definitely breeding arrogance. Always hire those MBAs a year after, not right when they're graduating is my advice. But he's also a general partner at XSeed Capital, a very cool Silicon Valley early stage venture capital firm that's doing very, very well. And I'm excited to have him on the podcast today, specifically because his book is coming out right now, published by McGraw-Hill, and it's called The Brains and Brawn Company, How Leading Organizations Blend the Best Digital and Physical. So what's interesting about Rob, among other things, after you get to know him here, is that he was an operator before turning VC, founded companies, senior exec at multiple VC-backed companies. I believe he sold a company that had hardware and digital to Kodak, as well as working with Andy Grove at Intel. That's something that we could all learn from at Stanford if you can get into his class, as well as GE Security Pixum, a semiconductor company. So when you look at Rob's background, he's got not only the digital experience that most VCs as lemmings are herd mentality racing after, but he actually knows something about hardware, supply chain, and all that jazz. So Rob, welcome to the pod. Great to see you.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So by the way, McGraw-Hill is my publisher. They gave me a very specific date, which was like years away from when the book was done. It took literally years. It was like a good student always finishes their paper and sticks it in the drawer and then pulls it out, as opposed to jolting, coughing their way through the night and delivering it, you know, half passed out. But McGraw-Hill does that. They put it in the drawer for I don't know how long, like waiting for Brian Cohen's book to come out and then mine. And then friends of mine said, hey, you wrote a book. I'm reading it now on Amazon. So it was on Amazon. Talk about hardware supply chain. They didn't even have their digital supply chain working. Now, I think that was 2013. But is your book out? I mean, this podcast should be released on the day people can buy it. So what is the specific date that it should be available?
July 27th. So if depending on when people are listening to this, if it's before July 27th, they can receive it on July 27th. If it's after July 27th, if you order it on Amazon, they'll ship it right away.
Yeah, as McGraw-Hill once said to me, don't promote something until people can buy it. So this will air on the 27th, and I predict I will be able to buy it before then, but if it's like mine. But at any rate, congratulations on writing the book. I think starting on your Stanford lecturing, it seems like not only do you have hardware experience, which is, you know, quite rare for Silicon Valley VCs that don't have a lot of silicon semiconductors left in the valley anymore. At Stanford, you've got a string of amazing CEOs that speak at your class as guest lecturers through your network. And listening to them talk about their big brawny hardware companies must just force you to think outside of the Silicon Valley bubble of hardware is hard, mistakes in hardware punishing, you know, it's in China or it's not here or whatever. Version 3, 3D printing, not good enough, you know, all that kind of stuff. But maybe before we get into it, and we'll talk about your book that's really bridging digital with physical and talking about how to go from physical to digital and digital to physical as opposed to just digital transformation, everyone says. But maybe start us with the genesis of where this maybe was coming from, and then we'll get into the book.
All right, so there are two classes of the five that I teach at Stanford that really kind of are the crux of the learnings that got put into the Brains and Brawn Company. The two courses, one's called The Industrialist Dilemma and one's called Systems Leadership. And the first course was started by me and Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box, and Max Vessel, who is now the Chief Learning Officer at SAP, has been with us since the beginning. And now Max and I teach it together. And the idea behind that class is, in a world where everything is connected, where every product is connected, that the way that you organize your company and the way you develop products has to change. And so we wanted to look at both incumbents and disruptors and look at best practices. But as you saw Silicon Valley companies going into sectors like mobility financial services, healthcare, et cetera, that some of the things that you needed to do, you needed to blend the best of both digital and physical. And so one of the key learnings was, A, every company who's going to be successful going forward is going to combine both digital and physical. The second thing that we learned was that kind of incumbents are not doomed and disruptors are not ordained. Like there are some people who were doing some best practices that were taking the best of both worlds. And the third thing is we found that the best leaders we were studying, you know, really had a new way of looking at leadership and what was required to manage in a world that blends digital and physical. And that's the course that I teach with Jeff Immelt, my old boss from GE, on systems leadership and looking at how things interact with each other. Because as everything is connected, leaders need to understand kind of what's almost the interaction between functions inside of an organization, companies inside of an ecosystem, and how do you manage those things well? And it's different than it was, the skill sets are required are different than they were 20 years ago.
So I started digging into the copy that you very thoughtfully, you know, emailed me over. And it seems like part of what you're saying too, is that a lot of the startups that we're funding from XSEED and RVC fund, they're planning on disrupting these big brawny companies. It might make sense for them to study a little bit of the, you know, resources and capabilities that they have and how some of that works, so they can even understand them. Also, frankly, a lot of the entrepreneurs that we're funding, and I know that you're funding too, never worked for Andy Grove. And they maybe don't even know who Andy Grove is, Intel, right? That how are they supposed to know, these Y Combinator, you know, young people, if they never had a chance to work at a large firm? So you seem to be describing some of what the dinosaur, the Stegosaurus has got a big spiky tail, right? Like,
right.
So you're describing some of that. Maybe talk a little bit about what disruptive companies should know. And then I want to get into your whole body parts, brain parts.
So, you know, we talk about hardware in the Valley. We often are talking about electronics, right? When people say hardware is hard, it's often talking about, people still think of it broadly speaking in the context of, you know, computers, computer systems, et cetera. But now we have to think about a world where things like when a car is connected, what does that mean? When an aircraft engine is connected, what does that mean? And so now we get into a complete different mindset that, like, you can't just like reboot if something goes wrong. Like, you know, people die if you get something wrong in certain industries. And so there are certain ways you can't go fast and break things when you're dealing with medical equipment. And so There's a mindset that's different. That you want to figure out how to develop quickly, use capabilities like Agile and Scrum, but you also need to understand, like, what is Six Sigma and why is it there? And now if you only do Six Sigma and you don't understand Agile and Scrum, you will not be quick enough, because you'll have some of these new companies coming into your market who are going to be behaving and acting much more quickly than the incumbents might. On the other hand, you know, the disruptors who come in, if they don't understand how to work with government, if they don't understand customer intimacy and really understanding, like, you can't just have like one platform and everybody's going to use the same thing. You need to really understand, how does your customer make money so that you can deliver the right goods and services to them? There's almost kind of a mindset that we can learn from these companies that have been around for a long time and that have survived a long time. You know, these are not stupid people who run these large organizations. And the best of the large organizations are taking the best thing that they've built over time, but they're also learning from, you know, the disruptors on ways that they can do things better.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen with companies like in the automotive space, like even Denso from Japan explaining to me that if something doesn't work right in their part of the car, someone's little girl could die. And they're just not going to let that happen. So it could be like a 5-year time horizon before your startup technology is truly deployed on the assembly line. On the other hand, they recognize that a connected car has a lot of opportunities. If you can read information off of a car or anything that's a physical device, that's a step one. Read and get that information, maybe pop it in a nice way to see it. And then two, write changes, make changes, and then say, if it does this, then do that. And so then you're on a path towards intelligent automation with real-time analytics and all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely different on the industry. If you're trying to sell movie tickets from the car, that doesn't need 5 years. You know, there's stuff that they're ready to do now that they transform. What is a car? Do you own it? Are you just in it? And can they capture, you know, part of that stuff? But people all talk about digital transformation and kind of getting your unsiloed data API'd out, cleaning it, structuring it, running through human intelligence programs for AI, and essentially automate some human workflows and get better outcomes that are more data-driven. You're talking about physical transformation. What does that mean to you, physical transformation? The physical.
So the physical, you know, we live in a physical world. And despite the fact that we've had a pandemic where everybody was on Zoom for 14 or 15 months, You know, the physical world is not going to go away. And so companies need to understand, like, what does it mean? You know, how do you make things? Like, one of the things we see in our students is that very few of them have actually been on a factory floor and understand what it means that if you're going to be, you know, in a manufacturing environment, what does a factory look like? How do you know if a factory is functioning well or not functioning well? And then how will things like automation and how will things like 3D, you know, you talked about 3D printing, how will that change the way things are manufactured? And so now you start to get into things like, if you've got an oil barge in the middle of the ocean, you know, an oil platform, you can actually put a 3D printing machine out there that if a part breaks, you can actually move the factory to the customer as opposed to the other way around. And so you start thinking differently about whatever you design, whatever software you design, whatever electronics you design, how that's going to work in that type of environment. And so I think you need to kind of completely rethink what is digital and what is physical and where do they blend and blur together. In fact, Brian Cornell, who's the CEO of Target, basically talks about blending and blurring, right? He doesn't think about e-commerce. He just talks about commerce. The shopping experience might start online, but you might drive to Target and get the goods put into your car. And that whole process combines both digital and physical and operational excellence and logistics. And so being good at all of those things is actually a skill set that we don't see kind of resident inside of, you know, what I'll call the traditional incumbents, nor the disruptors, as you were talking about in Silicon Valley. Very few people here have gotten their fingernails dirty, you know, doing hard manual labor. Most of my students don't want to go to work for John Deere. They want to go to work for Netflix.
And yet John Deere is getting into the venture capital business, and they'd be crazy not to. You know?
Exactly. And that's what we're seeing is the incumbents understand and they can learn from what's happening here in the Valley. And they're adopting a lot of those capabilities. Not everyone will get it right. Not everyone is going to do a great job. There will be some large companies who will die, but not all of them.
Well, rather than just let me ramble on with the conversation, I did a little bit of homework. So I want to point to some of the work you've done here. You talk about these body parts, that it almost sounds like you're getting to your own kind of Porter's Five Forces model, but you've got a number of specific skills that you kind of relate to these parts of brawn. Like you've got the right brain, the left brain, the hands, the muscles. Can you give us the cheat sheet on what you came up with there and at a high level what those main points are?
Absolutely. So the Brains of Brawn framework looks at five digital attributes and five physical attributes that we think capture, you know, what's really important on a go-forward basis that companies need to incorporate in order to successfully deliver connected products and services. And by the way, not every company is going to be great at all 10 of these, but the idea is that a person in an organization can look about where they're doing well and where they might need to improve. So the five digital attributes or the five brainy attributes, the first one's the left hemisphere, using analytics, right? Can you use analytics to actually serve your customers better? The right hemisphere, how do you manage creativity? We look at the amygdala, which is, you know, how do you use empathy to actually have relations with, you know, your employees, your customers, people in your ecosystem? The prefrontal cortex, how do you manage risk? And then finally, the last digital one is the inner ear, the last part of the brain, which is how do you balance what you own and where you partner? And then on the five brawny attributes, we look at things in the physical world that companies need to excel at. The spine is, can you manage logistics? Hands, the craft of making things. Muscles, can you operate at scale on a global basis? The inner ear, how can you drive and shape your ecosystem? Hand-eye coordination, how can you drive and shape your ecosystem? And then finally, stamina, can you survive over time? So those are the five physical attributes. And then in each of these 10 areas, we look at best practices of companies that we've seen do a really good job on each of these 10 attributes. And the hope is at the end, somebody can say, I'm going to rate my company on a 1 to 10 scale. and see how, you know, we do on each of these 10 attributes. A perfect score would be 100, you know, and no company's going to get 100. But you can kind of understand, like, where are we excelling and where might we have some holes that we need to improve on.
Okay, so I could see McKinsey and BCG scoring people, getting paid, and then benchmarking you of where you need to improve, you know, on some of these. I think I saw in your book that when you were talking about risk within the large corporation, I think of terms of like risk containment and how we mitigate risk with our portfolio construction and all the wizardry of venture capital. But you seem to be talking about putting someone in place to encourage people to take more risks, right? That they're naturally risk averse if they've ended up in that corporate and they don't want to get tarnished from taking a risk. And explain that.
So that's exactly it. You know, the idea is, generally speaking, people have been rewarded in large organizations for doing things a certain way. And that allows a company to scale, right? That's how companies can scale over time, by systematizing things. The problem is, if you deviate from that, you're going to have some times when things go wrong and large companies stop taking risks. And so we studied AB InBev. And one of the things that happened was the former CEO who just retired, Carlos Brito, he got his butt kicked by the board of directors one meeting where he had built the organization through a series of large acquisitions. And, you know, as you know, the taste of what people wanted to do and how they wanted to drink beer has been changing. The board said to him, look, there's no one else left to buy. We've got to start doing more innovative things so that we can be meeting the customers where they are. So he recruited one of his rising stars, a guy by the name of Pedro Earp, to become the chief disruptive growth officer. And Earp was like, Brito, what the hell is a chief disruptive growth officer? And Brito's like, I have no idea. Go figure this out. So Earp's idea was to figure out how to kind of allow the organization to take risks and do so systematically, but also aggressively, you know, by not only doing stuff like, you know, working with startups and Skunkworks and Adventure Arm, but creating the context and culture that this could happen. And then as he was considering the job, Earp went back to Brito and said, Brito, how do I know if I've been successful? Because I'm going to be so small relative to the, you know, I run this big group right now, and now you're going to put me in charge of this little thing. How will success be defined? And Brito says, you'll know you'll be successful when your job is no longer needed, because you will have infected the whole organization with your way of doing things. Now think about that for a second, Andrew. Brito told his rising star that he would be successful when he no longer had a job. Right. And so it kind of, this,
by the way, that reminds me of like, when do we close the patent office? When we're done? You've heard this, like people that worked at the US patent office, you know, said pretty soon we'll have trademarked everything, because, like, you know, people will not continue to invent things. And you're like, what?
Exactly. And so this was this notion that it was almost became personal for Pedro, that he was like, for me to be successful, right, I've got to take my attitude towards risk, got to be that I'm willing to take the risk with my career. But it became a great opportunity for him. So he really kind of helped change the structure and the culture. And he ended up getting promoted to the chief marketing officer as well, because he did such a great job. So the attitude towards taking risk is, you've got to push the company into its zone of discomfort. You've got to put a systematic way of thinking about risk. And people have to take that personally, believing that if they lean forward and they take some risks, if they fail, they're not going to get fired. So you have to see that there's protection from people at the top. You have to put a creative structure in place to allow people to be successful. And you've got to allow people to see that there's positive, you know, aspects to their career on the other side.
You know, in my second book, Masters of Corporate Venture Capital, we study corporate venture capital and, you know, what could be improved with the various settings that they have. And one thing is, imagine you've got the corporate venture capital unit. We were talking a minute ago about Denso, right? From Japan. They have people in Silicon Valley investing in things, and then they throw the idea back over to Japan to some business unit saying, hey, we found some innovation that's directly tied to what you're doing. The immediate response is pushback. It's resistance. Yep. That, you know, you work for a Japanese company in Japan, like, yeah, I'm going to be a guinea pig and inject myself with like something that needs an antidote. No way. Whereas, like, you know, Jeff Bezos, before he became like halfway to being an astronaut or whatever that was, Jeff Bezos naturally, you know, he's selling books and DVDs on the internet. So you're like, all right, I can buy the Rolling Stones album. I know it'll be the same. And then you saw him do women's jeans. I said, that'll never work. And then he did lawn furniture. I'm like, that'll never work. So his nature is, you know, experiment, almost like Apple. You know, we'll copy everything and we'll fund the hell out of it and release one new thing. So some companies like have Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, that naturally experiment and take risks. And other companies are these 200-year-old things that it's just not in their DNA. And I argue that it's not just having a corporate venture capital unit. It's getting the HR and the top down to say to every single person, your bonus is tied to the following things. And some of that is interacting with these external, you know, innovative people and companies and players and actually reward them, you know, make them realize that you just want to not do it. We got to make you do it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say that because I think that when I work with large organizations, the biggest challenge is cultural. Like we're not asking companies to bend light in a way that light's never been bent before. That's hard. But how do you get an organization of 50, 100, 250,000 people to go through these transformations and change? And a lot of it, again, it becomes personal. People have to choose to say that they want to do it. And I got to tell you, people hate change, Andrew. You know, we talk about change is constant and change is great. And that's certainly the mantra inside of Silicon Valley. And it's all bullshit, right? You know, people hate it. So you have to push yourself into your zone of discomfort. And you, by the way, you have to, people who aren't willing to kind of embrace that change, they can't stay in the company. Like you got to have to work to kind of, you got to give them the opportunity to excel, but you've also got to let them know that if they don't kind of get on board, they can't stay.
Right. Whereas the world around them is changing really, really fast. If the Japanese culture is wait for April of next year, wait for April of next year, and the Chinese are moving so fast, you're going to just see manufacturing, which was, you know, invented in the United States, perfected in Japan. The Japanese are going to be buying automated factory technology from the Chinese so that there is no 3D printing transportation of the device, and the Japanese will have missed it. So yeah, I couldn't agree with you more that the cultural thing is huge. So it looks like your five kind of body parts on the physical and the digital side become kind of archetypes to remind management, pay attention to these things and revisit and measure it. You know, measuring stuff in the corporate venture world is in itself an entire topic. You know, like how do you, you know, if making a 54x return means something in my fund, in your exceed fund, but to, you know, $100 billion company, you know, making, you know, 8 million in carry was exciting to me and life-changing, but to them doesn't do anything. Whereas if they can measure, did we buy a multi-billion-dollar reoccurring revenue business that migrated us out of a declining market and into an ascending market? You know, so the measuring of these things is extremely important, I think. You know, so do you talk about, you know, kind of analytics of how to?
So I'll take that in two parts. I'm actually going to, so in the context of brains and brawn, I tried to keep it simple, right? Good models are simple. So I tried to, said to people, you give your company on a 1 to 10 scale, a score for each variable, 1 being bad, 10 being good. And yeah, there's going to be some normative judgment there, but you know, like you be honest with yourself. It's, by the way, it's kind of like grading students. You read a paper and you have certain criteria to figure out whether it's a good paper or a bad paper, and you give them a score. Same thing if they're doing a problem set. They either got the answer right or they got the answer wrong. And so you try to keep it simple. I think good frameworks are very simple. You talk about something that's actually, I think, much harder, which is how do you measure something which doesn't have a score and yet you know has benefit?
So in the context of value rather than financial.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you learned something about what was happening outside of your four walls and your company was able to do something about it. In the academic literature, there's a notion of what's called the absorptive capacity of an organization, which is the ability to take data and bring it and information, bring it into your company and then have the company change. So one of the things like people can think about is what did we learn and did we change our behaviors because of what we learned? So it's not just the kind of like the sucking in of knowledge with this startup's doing this or that startup's doing that is, but did the company do something differently because of what it learned? Now in a corporate venture capital arm, right? Part of what you're gonna do is financial returns as you talked about, but there's also gonna be other information. And so I would argue the role of a CVC is not only for financial returns, but to make sure they infuse, you know, the information into other parts of the operating part of the organization and that the organization can then make better decisions for customers, change the behaviors, change the product, change the service, so that that will hopefully end up leading to other financial returns. Sometimes it's hard to measure that direct line, but if you can find out like, hey, we changed what we did based upon things that we learned outside of the building, that can be a huge reward and a huge way that companies can be knowing what's going on outside and they can value what's going on outside of the business.
100%. I think HR is incredibly important. Like the deeper I go down my little rabbit hole, the more I think HR is just incredibly important. It's like the biggest decision you'll ever make as an entrepreneur is you're choosing your co-founders, then your VCs, then your advisors. It's been people the whole way. Like, but I think it was Jackie, God, I can't remember her name. Like 15 years ago, the head of corp dev at Yahoo, was her business card said head of corporate development, meaning M&A, like I buy companies for Yahoo, and human resources. And I thought that was brilliant that, you know, everyone just says, you know, you don't even have to get an MBA to say like most M&A destroys value, right? You know, like we bought it and killed it, you know, kind of thing.
One of the things that Silicon Valley has done historically much better than, you know, what I'll call traditional incumbent companies is when companies get bought in Silicon Valley, oftentimes there's an understanding that you're buying the product, you're buying the service, but you're also you're buying the team. And oftentimes those teams will become leadership in the company that did the acquiring. And if you look at PayPal, you know, the Braintree leadership team, you know, really had a good run inside of the leadership team of PayPal for a long time and added a lot of value. You know, Bill Reddy ended up leaving and going to Google. But, you know, like he was there for a long time inside of PayPal. So you see that. And you know, when I was at GE and we'd buy companies, you know, like some of our culture, you know, our antibodies would be like, let's squeeze the hell out of this thing. And I'm like, no, that's the wrong answer. We want these people with us for another 5, 10 or 15 years. And so I think that's where, by the way, that example you give is a great example of where incumbent organizations can learn philosophically and culturally from kind of the ways to embrace a lot of the things that you can learn and do better from people outside. Kind of that just, it's about winning and it's about serving customers better.
Yeah, I think put simply, large corporations that are paying, that are interacting well with the innovation startup VC ecosystem will do better than if they don't. And so they should, and there's lots of ways of doing it. And it's communication is key. If you're not communicating it, then it's pointless. So if you're off in Japan and having a few guys run around doing something here, means nothing. So you got to figure out that communication. And even it's all about HR and even knowing, well, maybe we're going to automate all the accounting department and we're going to need more cybersecurity here. Yeah. So maybe we should retool our accountants to be cybersecurity people. They like looking at computers all day, don't talk to anybody.
So that's it. So in when I talk about the chapters on systems leadership, one of the things that we say is the leadership of, you know, tomorrow's organizations need to like anticipate where the next generation of AI, artificial of automation and analytics is going to displace other jobs. Like, you know, we had the first wave of globalization, which was basically moving low-cost manufacturing to Asia and low-cost engineering to Eastern Europe and low-cost customer service to India, but it was kind of a hub and spoke model, right? You still had a headquarters and everyone said, look, we're global. Now what's happening is with the continued improvements in communication and collaboration tools, like we're still going to have, I think companies will operate much more like mesh networks with centers of excellence in particular locations. And as that happens, you're going to have to figure out, by the way, there's going to be new jobs there's jobs in your organization that are going to go away in the next 5 years. In fact, you can probably anticipate that.
Yeah.
So great leaders need to be thinking about how do I retrain my teammates now so that they're ready to add value in 5 years when their existing jobs go away. If I can retrain them and keep them inside of the company, that's better for the bottom line of your company. It's good for society too. But like if nothing else, it's good economically. And so Leaders need to be anticipating this stuff because these changes are not gonna stop. It's just gonna happen more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that empathy, you know, archetype that you talk about is a good one of like, stop talking for a second and do some listening. And that'll help you make a decision on changes that need to be made to not be obsolete or get lost, not be Kmart getting squashed by Walmart. You want to be the Walmart crushing. But speaking of Walmart and then it's hard not to talk about Amazon when I think about all of this bridging between digital and the physical world. Why don't you pick two or three case study examples you can share with us today that make a point that would be of interest to our listeners of entrepreneurs, investors, and supporters of the system, ecosystem. Like maybe, I mean, you must, I believe you talk about Amazon.
I do. Well, so Amazon, yeah, Amazon is kind of right now kind of the best of the best that people would say of combining digital and physical. And, you know, oftentimes when I work with companies, I'll say, raise your hand if you're afraid of Amazon, and everyone's hand will go up. And it's, and if you're not afraid of Amazon, you don't understand. Part of it is just because they're just that good and they're that aggressive. You know, in each of the 10 areas, I try to highlight one particular company. Let me choose a few. And so strangely enough, like when I looked at analytics, the company I highlighted was Charles Schwab, you know, the large financial services company that has, you know, $7 trillion of deposited assets inside of their organization. And it's not like they are the best in world class of, you know, the various algorithms they're using for artificial intelligence. They're good at that. But I think what they do a great job of is always asking themselves, we have tons of data. What would our customers want us to do with this? Like, they have a North Star that guides how they think about using the information and using the data. So if you were to log on and, you know, go to Schwab and type, you know, life events divorce, Schwab might know ahead of time, Andrew, that you're thinking about, you know, a potential marital change, even before your spouse might. And the question they have to ask themselves is, what should they do about that? Right. And let's juxtapose that against a Facebook. Because right now, conventional wisdom, I would argue, is that people believe Facebook uses our data for their benefit, right? And by the way, economically, it's doing pretty well for them. But I would say very few people around the world trust Facebook to do the right things for us. And so one of the things about analytics is understanding not only how to be good at the data, but how to use the data. And that's kind of the keeping the human in the loop. I think, you know, you talked about empathy. The best example I saw of that was Bernard Tyson, the former CEO of Kaiser Permanente. When Bernard would come to class, he was running an $80 billion a year organization. And for him, he was always talking about, like, he would just sit and watch how his doctors and nurses worked one day a month, trying to understand what were his employees, what was their day like. See, he spent time talking to members and what are their issues. Like, one time before he came to class, he had met with a bunch of family members whose other family members had committed suicide. And he was listening to them, and what was the people who committed suicide, what was their experience like dealing with Kaiser Permanente? And you could just tell, like, it affected him deeply. And yet this was the same man who would meet with presidents, you know, would meet with presidents of the United States, trying to understand, like, what's going on. And you could see that he really kind of projected out, trying to understand, what is it that they're going through and how does that impact my business? You know, on the muscle side, you know, looking at some non-traditional companies.
Let's jump in a second. You know, I read that part of your book where it wasn't just that he himself had empathy, but that he managed to proliferate what he was deciding as a chief executive into the organization to give them, you know, forcefully empathy so that each person could say, think about health rather than, you know, bad fixing a broken body. Like, so he seemed to be transmitting it from the top throughout rather than just being Mr. Empathetic on his own.
Absolutely. The metrics they put in place were healthy life years. You know, they realized they did better financially if they kept their members alive and healthy as long as possible. Like, if you're a member, that's a pretty good thing that my healthcare provider wants to keep me alive and healthy as long as possible. Like, that's aligning incentives. You know, he used to stand up in front of class and say, in our time together, you might agree with me, you might disagree with me, but you'll never forget me. And like, when he would say that, literally I'd watch 100 students get goosebumps, and he could hold them in the palm of his hand. And he was just so great at connecting with people. On the muscle side, like, I want to talk about operating at scale. Like, one of the things about a connected world is, you know, you want to be able to operate globally. We look at Michelin, right? The French tire company, where they actually really think of themselves as a material science company, that they have a material science platform that allows them to make the perfect tires for each local geography. And so it's the idea that you can have, like, a platform, if you will, that, whether it's digital or whether it's physical, that can be used all over the world, but that can be customized in a particular region. And we, you know, that's kind of one of those things that where you see some non-traditional companies that we think of being innovative, doing some very innovative things, or even like Stamina.
On the Michelin, I think your book was saying that their classic Michelin tire was too expensive in, like, one market, and they lowered the price of it.
Well, what they had to figure out was let's look at China, right? China has a lot of low-cost tire manufacturers. And so if Michelin is a premium brand, how do they sell a tire that's appropriate for that market? And so that what they wanted to be able to do was come up with, you know, their material science capability allowed them to design a tire that could be high quality but substantively lower cost that would be appropriate for the Chinese market. And they would give it a brand that would be appropriate for the Chinese market. And one of the things the CEO said is a lot of people, the brand that they would use in China, people thought it was a Chinese company and not a French company. And so it was that ability to think about how to like have a customized solution for a customer in a particular segment or a particular geography, but base it upon a scalable platform that can operate on a global basis, which gives you lower costs, cost advantages, et cetera.
By the way, it sounds like they're going to survive when tires are no longer made of rubber. I met a family office in Jakarta, but actually in Singapore, they own all the rubber coming out of Indonesia. And they say, we know our days are numbered before no one uses rubber for tires. It's going to go to something else.
Right. And so again, that gets back to material science. Like, how are you going to be dealing with trying to use your capabilities and competencies to maybe come up with a substitute for rubber? And that's where I think Michelin's going to have a chance to execute. And that doesn't mean they'll be successful, but at least they see it and they know they're working towards it.
Yeah. You had another example?
The last one I would give is just stamina, Johnson & Johnson. And you've got this healthcare company that's been around for a long time. And you know they have this thing called the Credo. And the Credo, you see it when you walk into any Johnson & Johnson building. It talks about, you know, what does the company stand for? And there are four constituencies that they serve. And in order, it's the customers, it's the doctors and nurses, it's the communities they serve, and finally shareholders. All right. And so that gives you kind of that North Star that you're guiding towards. And then you look at how they've instituted, you know, certain things over the years where they'll have multiple product lines that are, you know, you have ups and downs of businesses, but that allows them to survive that if one particular group is, you know, having a particularly bad time, so there's that maybe some cyclical downward trends in one area, that other trends in their business might be up. You also see that you know, they do things like the way they institute innovation. They do a lot of stuff internally, but they also partner externally with JJDC and Johnson & Johnson Development Corporation. So they do a lot of different things, and that's been instituted for a long time. And so when they've had hard times, and they've had hard times, you see the problems with the opioid crisis, talc, et cetera. I believe that the notion of the Credo and the notion of how they structure their business has allowed them to survive the ups and downs that companies have. And so I think that just to see a company that's lasted that long, you try to understand why do some companies last and some companies don't. One of the things about stamina, we really saw kind of a North Star mindset, which again was similar to what we saw with how Schwab uses analytics. But we also saw the institutionalization of how they thought about innovation, that it was a part of what they did, and also how they thought about what businesses they were in.
Okay. In your book, you share two attempts at radical transformation, one at a traditional company that tried to add brains and one at a tech company that tried to add to master brawn. Can you tell us more and what are the lessons for other companies?
So like, by the way,
a lot of VCs write a book that's like, yeah, I got out of bed, I put my trousers on and I invested in Facebook. And then I got out of bed and I invested in Uber. Everything I touch turns to gold. It's like, this book gives me nothing actionable that I can do. So I like a book that's got an actual story, but like an actionable thing. So maybe tell us those two, and maybe some of our VCs and startups out there can do something specific.
So one of the things that we looked at two companies. We looked at 23andMe, you know, Anne Wojcicki's DNA organization, and now going into the drug development phase. And we looked at Daimler, the large automotive company, and we graded each of these companies on these 10 attributes, the 5 brain and 5 brawn. And what's interesting, we looked at 23andMe, and they actually did a very good job on the brain side. On the brawn side, a little bit less so, but they partnered with GSK to help with drug development and drug distribution,
and
which is how they're trying
to
use.
They're a young company, yes, compared to Daimler, right?
And Anne Wojcicki's a force of nature, right? If you ever have a chance to meet her or see her speak, she's incredible. And then when you look at Daimler, okay, Daimler is a manufacturing powerhouse and they're really good at what they do. They're an engineering powerhouse, but they really have not done a great job on things like analytics. I would argue they've done a very poor job on creativity, risk-taking. They didn't, they wanted to do everything internally on their own. They have not done a good job of shaping their ecosystems. And so when, I did the analysis, actually, 23andMe got a score of 82 out of 100 on the 10 variables. And Daimler got 65 out of 100. And you could say, Rob, that's crazy, right? Daimler's, huge, billions and billions of dollars of revenue and many more employees. And my point being is that I think Daimler is actually in a world of hurt. They're in a lot of trouble because, the mobility industry is changing drastically. And if you look at what it's going to take to be successful in the future mobility industry, they are not getting it done. And I would argue 23andMe has leaned in on a lot of the trends of blending digital and physical, and where they are not strong, they've partnered in a smart way. So even if, for example, on the manufacturing side, they get a very low score, but they partnered with GSK for that. And they've done very well in the other scores. So the idea is that it's not like it's going to be a perfect score and say, aha, this is your destiny. It's an opportunity for a company to look at itself and say, how are we doing right now? And I think, you look at Daimler, I think that they're going to be in real trouble over the next 5 to 10 years. And by the way, they're really smart. They're over 100 years old, but right now they're being constrained by their past. They're getting their butt kicked by Tesla. They're not doing, connected cars and autonomous driving particularly well. And we'll see if they get to the other side. The jury's out. But, right now, I think they've got a lot of work to do.
Well, maybe we could help them with their venture arm. They're active, but I often think these guys are like, they have a cockpit and an airplane and the settings could be just moved a little bit to get a better outcome of what they're trying to do. They've got a lot of important resources and brawny resources and capabilities, but maybe a real German risk-averse culture to the core of their DNA.
Remember, they've been Germans successful.
Germans have changed a lot.
Remember, they've been successful in what they've done to the past. So it's hard to change when you've been rewarded for doing something a certain way. I mean, I remember there's a great quote that somebody there told me, that I wasn't, when I wrote my Daimler case, that I couldn't put in, it was like the person said, Rob, I know how to design a great car. Like, I know how to do that. Elon Musk is talking about going to Mars. Right, it's a whole different mindset when people think about Tesla and when they think about what that means. And so that's how they kind of need to also kind of culturally reinvent themselves and their attitude towards risk and change.
And what are some of the things that, and maybe this entire conversation is the answer to the question I'm about to ask, but how many years have you been doing GSB at Stanford?
I've been teaching here for about 18 years since I first started with, doing my first few class sessions. My dean's appointment came about a decade ago. So I'm bald and my beard's gray.
Okay. It must help you think outside the Silicon Valley bubble of just VCs meeting founders and other VCs. What are some core things that you've been able to see without getting pulled off the cliff with the rest of the worthless roadkill lemmings that are venture capitalists?
Well, for all I know, I'm a worthless, lemming venture capitalist. So I don't know that I'm any different than anybody else. I think that one of the great things about being at Stanford is it's a very, global perspective. Our students come from all over the world, from every continent. I'm able to study companies all over the world, from Europe to South America to the Middle East to Asia, Africa. And so you get to see things that, there are 7.5 billion people on the planet. Sometimes we have a myopia in Silicon Valley. And so I think that's one of the blessings. And I think one of the things I'd encourage investors to do is to be thinking and looking elsewhere. There's a lot of really neat things that are going on elsewhere. I think the other thing is you kind of hit it right on the nose. Like, don't be confused. Like, if you're a slimy, scum-sucking venture capitalist like you and I, we're only good at our jobs if we deliver returns to our LPs. Like, kind of full stop. Everything else is marketing and kind of bull hockey, right? Our job is to, help entrepreneurs, be successful. But that's our job, is to help entrepreneurs, and kind of that's it. And, the economics of our business is you're looking for Godzilla, right? You are looking for that 10, 20, 30, 40X. If you do that, you're a genius. If you don't do that, you're an idiot. And everybody in our business went to a top university and everybody works 24 hours a day. You can't outthink people and you can't out-hustle people, right? So, you try to find the great investments, give them money, help the entrepreneurs if they need it, but like, that's your job. Like, don't be confused. And if you're looking for something different, look outside of the valley.
Okay. And what's the one thing that you would like people to see with this book? If there's one thing to, you hope readers will take away, like Eric.
Okay, I'm gonna say two things as opposed to one. Number one is the winning large organizations in the future will combine both digital and physical, and they're gonna be good at both. And the second thing I'm gonna say is the leadership competencies that are required, you know, what I call systems leadership, are different than what it's taken to be successful in the past, right? If you don't understand how the physical world works, you won't be successful. And if you don't understand how the digital world works, you won't be successful. You've got to figure out how to do both and figure out, you know, how are you going to stay current in a world where everything is connected?
Okay. So I think that these case studies are a great way for people of all different ages and places to school up and collapse that into a couple of pages. And how is this influencing your Exceed? You're a general partner at a cool venture capital fund, and we're not, you and I don't operate the biggest multi-billion-dollar VC funds, for better or for worse. So hardware can be expensive, it can be punishing, it take a long time. What are your takeaways from all of your research, and how is that tying into your venture capital practice?
Well, yeah, I'm involved not only Exceed as a general partner. I help a fund called PIVA, where I play a role as a venture partner. I'll sometimes advise other organizations that'll call me. What I will say is, if you're going into a business where you're actually going to be doing kind of the physical side, you know, make sure you understand time to market. Make sure you understand the capital requirements. Make sure that you really understand kind of what it's going to take over time. And by the way, it's going to take longer and cost more than whatever the entrepreneur is telling you. And make sure that you can get venture backable returns within the time frame of relevance, right? That's also, I think. So the first is, you know, making sure that people understand kind of like, can you make money on this investment? And then I think the other thing that I tell people is that they're working with their portfolio companies, encourage the entrepreneurs to be thinking about the competencies and skill sets that are needed inside of the organization to be successful. If you don't have people who can blend the best of digital and physical, it's, you know, you're going to end up not getting the access to the profit pools inside of the ecosystem and inside of the market that you need, because the people who can do that, that's who's going to win.
Okay. And I'll put a link to Amazon in the show notes for this, but who's the audience of the book? I could attempt to answer the question myself, but we might as well ask the author. Who should read the book?
If you are an incumbent organization that is blending digital and physical, you know, everything from the C-suite kind of the manager level, right? I'm going to argue that those are the people, because the product people who are building and designing things all the way on up to the senior leadership. If you are in a digital company based in the Valley, or you're based in Berlin, or you're based in Shanghai, or wherever you are, and you are selling products and services to, you know, companies that are designing your capabilities and competencies into their physical products, do you understand your customers? Right? They will also find this book of interest. And again, like, you know, we talked about some of the incumbent companies. We also study in the book Instacart, Google with Android, Stripe. So, you know, we study companies both from kind of Silicon Valley DNAs as well as, you know, physical DNAs, and talk about best practices.
Well, very cool. Well, listen, I will, let's speak offline. I can help you maybe get into Chinese, Japanese, and Russian, and Italian, and a bunch of other languages. It sounds like this has got a global audience. But Rob, this has been great. Why don't we end it here, but stay on you and me for a few minutes. Thank you so much, and best of luck with the initial release of the book.
Thanks, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.